can change, I can change, I can change. But I'm here in my mold. I am here in my mold. But I'm a million different people from one day to the next. I can change my mold. No, no.
Welcome back, everybody, to another really, really special edition of Cashville. This is James Martinez. I am here today after a long, long, long time. It's taken me almost 10 years to set up this interview, believe it or not. Our special guest today is Dr. Richard Bandler. He is the co-founder of NLP. You've heard me talk about him time and time again, and I often read passages out of his book. I've suggested techniques for all of you that are going through a financial crisis and going through massive changes in your lives to research and utilize some of Dr. Richard Bandler's work. For those of you that this is totally new, because I know we have listeners from all over the world, you may go to the following website and read a little bit about him. He has three great books. I've purchased one of them. I'm about to get the other two, obviously. RichardBandler.com. For those of you that don't know, Dr. Richard Bandler is considered the greatest hypnotist in the world right now, actually. He has a long, long background. I could go into his resume, but you can probably research that yourself. Dr. Richard Bandler's got enormous amounts of YouTube videos, research material. Of course, his books have been around. He's been around a long time. He's probably the top person in the world that does behavior modification and whatnot. Highly, highly, highly recommend that you purchase his books. You go to his seminars. I'm telling you, this is the way for all of you that have had struggled with enormous amounts of change. This person is a pioneer, has been called a genius by many, many people. I'm very honored, and it's taken me a long time to actually line this up. But Dr. Richard Bandler, welcome aboard.
It's nice to be here.
How are you doing? How are things going with you in your world?
Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
I wanted to ask you, I know you are constantly, you're doing seminars, you have new books out, you've been constantly doing this for a long time. As far as what I've always wanted to ask you is, like, today a lot of people are dealing with financial issues and going through massive transformation and having to deal with that. In your seminars right now, or people that have individual clients or whatnot, is this a recurring thing that people are dealing with, as financial infrastructure and restructuring their lives internally so they can deal with the changes that are occurring economically? Or what do you see as a trend?
Well, actually, you know, I've been at this for four decades, so I've been through a few recessions that were called the worst recession. And so this isn't a new theme. And, you know, as with any crisis, whether it's a death in the family, the death of a loved one, breaking up of marriage, all kinds of things happen where people have to reorganize their lives. And the people that do it well are the people that focus on, you know, that with their strengths and get rid of their weaknesses. You know, I don't know which of the three books you're talking about, but the one, Get the Life You Want, has a whole section that's about getting over things. Because if you dwell upon what you lose, you end up losing more. And if you restructure and become determined, there's literally nothing people can't do. One of my clients that I had recently left Vietnam after the Vietnam War and came here, made a lot of money, and managed to lose it in a very short period of time. But like he said to me, he said, when I got here, I had nothing, and I ended up with a lot, so it's not impossible to do it again. And, you know, people have to understand that times change, professions change. You know, our auto industry has been certainly tested. I remember back in the 1970s being at a board of directors meeting of a large auto manufacturer and looking out into the parking lot, and over a third of the cars were Japanese. That scared me. It didn't seem to worry anyone else. But, you know, the thing is that mentally we're all capable of being really determined. And in our brain, there are things that we've been determined to do in the past. And if we think about those things and recapture those feelings and literally spin them inside ourselves, then pretty much you can cope with anything. And even the people that haven't been directly influenced by the recession, people who lost their jobs or, you know, their houses are being repossessed or their finances are in absolute chaos, it's amazing how many people have just buried themselves in credit card debt It's almost like legal loan sharking, if you ask me.
You're exactly right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, it is. I mean, if you miss one payment, your interest rates go through the ceiling and what used to be called usury. And mm-hmm. I don't know how they were able to legalize this, but they're like bandits. You know, mm-hmm. one of the hardest things to teach my kids was to not use their credit cards. And if you do use them, pay them off at the end of the month. If you're mm-hmm. going to owe somebody money, credit card companies are the wrong people. Yeah. But, you know, if you're not careful with your assets when you have them, then when hard times come, you know, then you're really digging a deep hole and you have a tendency to dig a deeper one. But mm-hmm. there has to be, a lot of people have to realize that when you hit bottom, the nice thing about the bottom is that it's solid. And if you think about it that way, it can teach you a lot of lessons. You know, if you lose your job and you have to reorganize, you can think about it as the end, or you can think about it as a really long-term beginning where you re-educate yourself and make yourself much more indispensable than you obviously were before.
Mm-hmm. You know, I deal with hundreds and hundreds. I've been doing this well over 10 years, dealing with people with financial issues. And I've modeled or I've suggested that they use some of your techniques because there's so much self-loathing, there's shame, there's fear that they can't make enough money. There's all these weird characteristics that people have when they come to me with this, you know, credit card debt issues. And if it's not fixed, they'd go back and do it again. Because I've talked to people that repeat the same bad behavior over and over again, and they get themselves into the same financial problems. Like when people come to your seminars and they're looking for fundamental change, what are some of the techniques that you would suggest that they can install that are that they can do themselves over and over again just to make sure to reinforce that new behavior?
Well, one of the major things I teach people is to control their brain. It's the one thing that you can control. Maybe you can't control the economy and you can't control, the rampant spending of our politicians, but you can control your own brain. And since we're only born with two natural fears, loud noises and falling, all the rest of it we've learned. And some of us have learned it really well. And what I try to teach people to do is to go back and look at the things that scare them. And typically in their brain, they're big pictures. They're life-size. They're larger than life. And if people literally shrink those pictures down to a small circle, what happens is it reduces the intensity of the anxiety. And if they have voices in their head screaming at them, they have to learn to turn the volume down and push the voices off into the distance and put in more reassuring voices. Because if you can get your brain, because you see, it's not just about how you feel. It's about the neurochemistry that's triggered by it. And when you think determined thoughts and when you think, you know, you can do things and when you have positive beliefs, it literally affects your neurochemistry so that you think more intelligently. The worst thing about feeling bad is it leads to making bad decisions. So when, you know, people are feeling overwhelmed, they'll make the decision to use their credit cards when they shouldn't. And getting your emotions, quote unquote, under control, it's done by organizing your own internal mental processes. And, you know, if you've read my books, I've been writing books for 40 years, which mm-hmm. basically are instruction manuals for the brain. They're about how to run the software in the brain, how to tell the difference between what you believe strongly and what you don't. If you think of a really strong belief and something that you're unsure of, typically the pictures will be in a different place in your mind. They'll be a different size, a different distance. One may be in color and the other may be in black and white. One may be a movie and one may be a slide. And one of the other things is that when people are making bad decisions, they have a tendency to make still pictures and try to make decisions from them rather than running movies into the future and seeing how it's going to influence them, where they can see themselves in a new car and it, you know, looks like it would feel wonderful. They don't run the movie about having to make payments for 5 years, you know, and being strapped and not being able to go out to dinner and having that payment book sitting there in front of you and watching your income get zapped and getting older and having no money put away. You know, if you run a little bit longer movies and you make sure the longer the movie goes, the better off you are, that's how you put a good direction in your life. It's called planning. And the famous
right.
process, by the way, is called thinking.
Right, exactly. No, I deal with a lot of non-financial planners that had no idea all this. They were not prepared for any of this, and they're stuck into deep, I mean, there's a lot of anger, fear associated. Hello? You still there, Dr. Richard?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I got cut off for a second.
Okay. Well, let's go into your books, because I know you have three books out, and I've talked about them on the air multiple times. Let's go into Conversations with Richard Bandler. What is this? It says Owen Fitzpatrick, a colleague of yours, did these interviews. What is that one particularly about that's different from the other ones that you have currently now?
Well, Owen Fitzpatrick is probably the youngest person that ever came and trained with me, mm-hmm. and he's now a master trainer, but he was a young kid from Dublin, and as time went by, I used to live on the west coast of Ireland, and he would come out and visit me and sit around the fire and ask me a lot of questions. And a lot of times people would come up to me in seminars and go, gee, I wish I could have been a fly on the wall. And as it turns out, he had recorded a lot of these conversations, which are unlike most of my books, which are really techniques. This is how you get rid of a phobia. This is how you get rid of a fear of heights. This is how you quit smoking, and this is how you stick to your financial plan. These were a little bit more philosophical in nature. And it's really about, I told him about going to Tibet and meeting shaman and all kinds of things. And literally I told him, if you don't experience the world, you really can't talk about it much. So he literally recapitulated. He went to the places I went in India and Tibet and all kinds of places like that. So the story is doublefold. Once it's part of it's the conversations we had about how to become a better person and how to become, yourself, somebody who has creative ideas and does things so that you become the source of your own creativity. And on the other side, it's the story of his going and looking at things in the world. So it's the most sort of autobiographical thing I've ever done. I'm not really much into autobiographical kind of things. I'm more of a technique-driven person.
Right. I know you've traveled the world and you've different types of cultures and different people and places where you've done seminars and one-on-ones with people. Do you find that in other cultures, the problems which they come to you with, like, because I know you do a lot of work in England, is some of the problems that they come to you with, the phobias and the cultural conditioning issues, are they very different than here in America? Or different for different countries?
Well, there's obvious differences. If you go to a place with no tall buildings, you really don't get a lot of fear of heights. But when you're in India, there's a lot of fear of dogs, which, you go to England, everybody seems to love dogs. There are some cultural things like this, but pretty much what I've discovered is when you get down to the raw things about people, we all mentally do the same processes, whether you believe there's one God or 150 gods, you still do it with the same brain. And, if you're a good planner, you speak Hindi as your natural language, you use pretty much the same process. I've discovered that wealthy, successful people in every country are very much alike. And that terrified, helpless people that have a tendency to be self-destructive, no matter what country from, they're very much alike. And what they're alike in is the way they process their thoughts and how they let them spin out of control and how they don't plan into the future and how if they've got a big problem, they don't attack it a little bit at a time. They wish it would go away. And I'm fond of saying you can wish in one hand and poop in the other and slap yourself in the face, and only one of them sticks.
Great. Yeah, it's good. That's good. No, I've seen a lot of your work, and I've seen you do one-on-one. Why is it, because some people I know that have gone, not necessarily to your seminars, that have the problem with, they go in, they learn some of these techniques, and they work for like a week or so. They have a high for about a week, and then some of it, they go back to their default behavior, and then it doesn't work again. Is this happening because when they do some of these changes or their anchoring states or things like that, they're not testing them and re-looping it over and over again continuously with somebody?
Also, I have to point out, I'm not responsible for what goes on in other people's seminars. I know in my seminars, what I try to teach people is that this isn't something that happens to you. It's not that somebody anchors you or somebody hypnotizes you. It's that you learn a new way of thinking, and as long as you keep thinking in a new way, you have new behaviors. This is why I have a tendency with my clients to teach them how to get rid of their own fear, because then if another fear comes along, they can get rid of it, or for some reason the other one comes back, they can take 10 minutes and get rid of it. The second book I wanted to talk about, Get the Life You Want, mm-hmm. is a really good instruction manual. When I wrote that, I got the idea because I was in my kitchen, and I was trying to make something, and I didn't know how to make it, and I popped open a cookbook, and I looked in it, and it suddenly hit me like a freight train. It said, this is a really good format. Wouldn't it be nice if there's a book you could just look up, fear, haunted by bad memory, just look up what was going on and follow a little procedure step by step. And, you know, there are a lot of people that I get are dwelling on past memories. This seems to be a reoccurring theme that psychologists have spent like five decades convincing us that, you know, our past causes our future, which doesn't seem to me to be all that unobvious to most people. You know, if you're born in one country, you speak one language, and if you're born in another, you speak another language. But the fact that, you know, we have a past doesn't limit our future. I like to tell my clients the best thing about the past is that it's over. And the best thing about the future is you can make it anything you want. But if you're still thinking about the past, so much of psychology, they have people go back and relive trauma like once wasn't enough.
Right.
And, and we've literally tried this for, you know, for 70 years, and it just doesn't work. The idea in psychology is that if you understand your problem, mysteriously it will disappear. And, you know, like I had a guy that when he was 5 years old fell in a river and almost drowned, and he was terrified of water. Mm-hmm. I had people that went and saw Jaws and couldn't take a dip in a lake in Kansas where there are no sharks. And
right.
They understood where their problem came from, but it still was there. And the truth is, if we can learn something that stupid that quickly, then we should be able to learn something better just as quickly.
Absolutely. There's a question that came on my board here from TJ in LA who asked this for you, Dr. Bandler. Does the work of Count Alfred Korbinsky still hold credence, and does training in, quote, general semantics yield results commensurate to ones he's aiming for? I'm not sure what he quite means by that, but do you understand that question?
I don't know exactly. I know who he's talking about. I'm not quite sure I understand the question. Did he say, is it relevant? Is general semantics relevant?
Mm-hmm, right.
The answer is generally.
Right.
I mean, when I studied general semantics 40 years ago, the information that I got from Korzybski was that, is that language molds the way we think. If you grow up speaking German, you don't even have modal operators of possibility. You don't have words like might and good. And when they translated my books, it was like a nightmare, because I keep asking people, what would you like to have happen? And in German, you have to say, what must happen? And, there are cultural differences that are molded by our language. German didn't even have a word for mind. You could describe the concept with a paragraph, but there wasn't a word. And when they translated my books, I said, well, maybe it's time you had one. And they went, well, what word would we use? And I said, how about the word mind? You know, define it and then just start using it. It becomes part of the culture. Again, the fact that certain things are molded by our understanding and how we process semantics doesn't mean that we can't learn to think differently. If there's anything I've discovered in the past 40 years, because every single client that I've had has been given up on by everybody, whether it was a physical thing or a mental thing or a learning disability or any of these things, when they come to me, they've tried everything. They've been psychoanalyzed, they've had electric shock, they've had all kinds of idiotic things done to them in psychotherapy. And most of the time, it takes me 10 or 15 minutes because I don't try to repair the past. It's just too much work. In fact, like even with things like spelling, when, I got my first learning disabled teacher came to me, which was a pretty good name for her, by the way. she brought me, you've got five kids that were learning disabled. And I said, well, what is it they can't do? And she gave me a list. They couldn't spell, they couldn't add, they couldn't this, they couldn't that. And I asked her, I said, how do you spell the word necessary? And she started to tell me what letters. I said, no, I don't want to know what letters are in the word. I want to know how you do it. How do you know what letters are in the word? And her eyes shifted up and to the left, and obviously she was making a picture. And I said to her, I said, do you see an image? And she said, yes. I said, how big are the letters? And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you're looking at letters. How big are they? And she said, well, they're about 12 or 13 inches. And I said, do you teach kids to make a picture in their head of words with, you know, letters that are 12 inches high? And she looked at me totally miffed. So I took these kids and I sat them down and I wrote words with a felt pen. And I made each letter a different color. I also made the letters 12 inches high. And then I had them make a picture of it in their head, and they could suddenly spell it forwards and backwards. And then I taught them to look at words on the list of their spelling list and to put them up in their head, make the letters different colors and make them big. And suddenly the next day, they could spell. And that's because I didn't think there was a psychological problem. I didn't think they were learning disabled. Mm-hmm. They just weren't using the same mental process as someone who's successful. NLP is the study of successful behaviors. And not just external behaviors, but mostly internal ones. Whether it's art, music, literature, or balancing your checkbook, there's a right way to do it. And the people who are successful at it are thinking about it in a way that works. The same thing is true about motivating yourself. You know, it's really easy to lose a job, but to be the person who goes out and gets another one right away, you got to think about it right. You got to think about it and feel the strongest desire. You know, it's funny, if people look down and see a $100 bill laying on the ground, they never hesitate to pick it up. Mm-hmm. And if your neurology and your brain could look at it and go to be the first one to grab it, that means your neurology is capable of that behavior. And if you take the same mental image, the same feelings that you would put with that, and instead of looking at a $100 bill, you replace a $100 bill with going out and doing job interviews and making cold calls if you're in business and all the things that everybody knows make you successful. You know, it's funny. Most of the people know what works. They just don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me, your ability to make this change lasting, and it's so quick for people. I know people that are so strung out on so many prescription meds and so forth. When somebody, like, if you're going to deal with somebody one-on-one, do you ask them to stop taking all that stuff, go through withdrawals, and then
I don't ask. I insist.
You insist. Okay.
If they're under a psychiatric care or a doctor's care, I get the doctor to administer the dose slowly before I ever see them. Because, you know, and they always tell me the same thing. They go, if you take them off a medication, their symptoms will go worse. They'll be bouncing off the walls. My answer is that's just exactly how I want them. The crazier, the better. that, you know,
right.
My job is to get them to be able to control all these thoughts and voices and feelings so that they can aim them in a fruitful direction. Because if you think about it, you know, the same machine that produces anxiety and fear and inner turmoil is like a nuclear generator. You could use what it generates to power, you know, an aircraft carrier, or you could use it to destroy a country. Mm-hmm. The question isn't, you know, whether power is good or bad. The question is, do you harness it? And, you know, all of the, you know, the emotional intensity that a person has, if it's channeled in the right direction, they become a more successful person. And, you know, because people are not only afraid, they're afraid of being afraid. And it spins back on itself, and then they start questioning themselves with self-doubt. And it's funny, they're filled with self-doubt, but yet they trust the doubt. When people come to me and say that, you know, they're suffering from insecurity, I always go, are you sure? And inevitably they say yes.
And they must give you that same stare that they always do. Oh, like they don't know. Yeah, I know. I understand. I know you got another book out, Richard Bandler's Guide to Transformation. What is different about this particular book?
Well, over the years, I've written a couple of dozen books. And basically what I did is over the years, I've changed the way in which I've used my own techniques. That I take change seriously. I don't just talk about it. I do it myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back in 1975, when I wrote a book about the meta model, I was modeling the way psychotherapists used language. And here we are 40 years later. I think about it entirely differently. So I wanted to go back and show how I use language patterns. They're the same ones I teach in sales training courses about how to ask questions so that you're leading your mind toward success and the people you work with. It's also a book about how to use language patterns to induce altered states, because I believe most successful behaviors are trance states, that people who are great artists, great musicians, great salesmen, great athletes, that it all has to do with being in the right state of consciousness at the right time. We have a certain trance we drive in, and that prevents us from hurting ourselves and other people. Mm-hmm. And learning that all of these discrete states of consciousness, you know, aren't good or bad, it's not that you're under hypnosis. We all go into altered states, and if we master those altered states, we do better. And getting the right altered state there at the right time seems to me to be the trick. So not only is it a good review of the techniques that I've developed over the years, but it's kind of an update of them and how they're made more relevant and they can be used quicker. And there's, you know, there's a lot of good stories about a lot of the clients, because on a scale of 1 to 10, I've had the 10s when it comes to crazies over the years.
Well, now, I find it's unusual that they everybody sends you, and they've given up on somebody, they send them to you, and then you happen to fix them over and over again. Now, what are some of the acute cases of people that have come to you that have had, you know, substantial blocks that have impeded them from flying or going in elevators or doing something that what kind of examples have you dealt with?
Well, I had a pilot with a height phobia. How's that?
Oh my God.
Doesn't get any weirder than that. He was fine if he was up in the air, but, you know, until he was in the plane going down the runway, he couldn't walk up the stairs to the plane. You know, they literally had to blindfold him and take him up the stairs. And then once he was in the plane, he was okay. I mean, this doesn't make any sense. You know, and, you know, they rooted around in his childhood and tried to connect it with his mother and everything else. And I put him in a trance and told him to stop it. You know, I mean, literally, if you have fear in your body, it always moves in a certain direction because your feelings can't hold still. And your feelings either tumble forward, rotate back, or go clockwise or counterclockwise, because those are the only choices. And with a guy like him, you know, after 8 years of psychotherapy and an investment of $200,000, he comes to me, and I said to him, which way does your fear move? And he looked at me and he goes, I don't know. And I said, well, take your finger and spin it forwards and think about walking up the stairs. And if that doesn't fit, spin it in the other direction. Spin it backwards. Does that fit? And he goes, yeah. I said, good. And then keep it spinning. Spin it a little faster. You'll get a little more scared. I said, then slow it down. Spin it in the opposite direction and imagine going up the stairs. And then I took him outside and we walked up 4 flights of stairs with him doing that. Never bothered him again. Because to me, I'm not worried about where it came from. See, my job's a lot easier. A psychologist is like an archaeologist. He has to root around in the soil of your life and find out where the buried bones are. All I have to do is give you the tools to walk forward.
Wow. That's an amazing story. If he was a pilot, how did he learn how to be scared of flying when he's already flying or getting to flying?
He wasn't afraid of flying. He was only afraid of climbing. It's a different task. And, you know, he started out, I guess, in the Air Force and, you know, had to hide it, and, you know, and the more he went up and down the little ladders, but I guess, you know, the bigger planes you fly, the bigger the ladder is. Now, it's one thing to be at the airport and walk out that nice little ramp. That didn't bother him at all. But when you land at some big airports like Heathrow, then you have to go down a set of stairs. And that terrified him. Plus, he couldn't look out of second-story windows. And by the way, I know exactly how a fear of heights works. I do this all the time. People tell me they have a fear of heights, and I always look at them and I say, and you get out of bed as soon as you wake up, just pop out of bed, don't you? And they always look at me and go, well, yeah. And I go, and they always look at me and they go, what does that mean? And I go, well, it doesn't mean anything other than you motivate yourself easily. And people who motivate themselves by seeing themselves doing something and feeling as if they are can be motivated very quickly. But if you see yourself jumping over the edge of something, that's not a very good mental strategy to use. So you teach them to go in their minds and instead of seeing themselves falling off the edge of things, seeing themselves stand there and being calm and safe and secure and holding on to the handle, and suddenly the fear disappears. Fear is a protection device in the mind to get you to stop doing dangerous things. And if you overcompensate and get the fear running before there's actual danger, it gets you in trouble. And because when people are scared and when they feel bad, they don't have the right chemicals in their mind to make very good decisions. You know, when people are really depressed, they have a tendency to fall in love with the wrong person. You know, people break up with somebody, they go out and have 50 drinks and then try to decide who to fall in love with. Not a good choice. Mm. You want your brain in the best, you want to be in the best state of mind to make the best decisions. It's not that making a good decision will make you feel good. You should feel good before you make good decisions, before you make decisions. Mm-hmm. You'll make better decisions that way.
Absolutely. Do you have a lot of couples that come to you that are on the verge of breaking up and they don't want to break up?
I don't see couples that much. Not really the nature of my business. When Virginia Satir was alive, every once in a while she would refer a couple to me, and they would typically they would come in screaming and yelling at one another, and I would sit there and just stare at them for a while, and then I would look at them and go, I'm sorry, you must be the wrong people. And they would go, what do you mean? And I said, well, I was supposed to see a married couple. And they would always look at me and go, well, we are married. And I'd go, to each other? And they'd always go, they'd look at me and they go, well, of course. And I'd go, and is this why you got married? So you could yell and scream at each other. And then you take them back and get them to think about when they very first fell in love. And you amplify that feeling and spin it faster and faster and faster. And then ask them if what they were talking about seems important anymore. And typically it disappears. You know what a good formula for marriage is that you have to give 10 really good compliments for every complaint.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, I completely agree with that.
You know, and also a lot of couples, you know, have a tendency to fight because, and they think what they're fighting about is important, and it isn't. It's that they're stressed out about money and time. And, you know, they're directly related to each other. And to me, you know, if you have the more that couples plan to have a good, solid financial future, the less trouble they're going to have with each other. Mm-hmm. And the more that they think about their time as if, you know, because the currency of life is how you spend your moments. And if you walk in the door and hug your wife for 2 seconds and sit down and, you know, kick your shoes off and click on the news, then really what you're saying is that the news is more important than the fact that you could have hugged your wife for 20 seconds, you know.
Right.
And in fact, there are oxytocin is released when you have sustained contact. This is why autistic children, when they inject them with oxytocin, suddenly begin to recognize faces. And their inability to have contact produces the wrong mental chemicals for them to learn to recognize what facial expressions mean and all these things. And it's not just true about autistic children, because some of us, the later we get in life, get a little autistic about our relationships. We fall in love, everything's hot and heavy, and then 5 years later, we almost never have contact. And that's not really the correct way to live. You have to spend your time like you're spending diamonds. You know, because the only difference is what you have in the bank, you know how many dollars you have to spend. You don't know everything that's going to happen because somebody might get sick, your car might break down. So there's unexpected stuff, and if we're a good planner, we plan and keep a little reserve back. But when it comes to the moments of your life, these are even more critical about how you spend them. And if you spend them wisely, if you think of them miserly, and you think, you know, people who are stuck in traffic for an hour driving home come to me and complain they never have time for themselves. You know, life is very paradoxical if you don't look at how to spend your moments wisely so that you enjoy them and so that you enjoy especially the people that you love and especially that you're with, your kids and your wife. I try to tell people to become the person their dog thinks they are.
Explain that a second. Go ahead. Tell me about that.
Well, you come in the door, your dog looks at you like you're the most wonderful person on the face of the earth. It's thrilled. It's absolutely convinced you've been doing nothing but perfect things all day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you take that as a model of how you should think about yourself, that, you know, if you actually make your goal to become the person your dog thinks you are, you know, then you're going to treat your kids better. You're going to treat your wife better. You're going to take more moments and spend them with these people and make sure that you spend 100% of your attention. You know, even when you chew your food, you should really taste it and chew it. You know, God put your nose over your mouth for a very deliberate reason. And that's
right.
So you would smell what was going in. Otherwise, he would have put it over your ass.
Exactly. No, I'm interested in, like, you've dealt with a lot of really successful people. And you mentioned earlier that there's an underlying, like a similar thing that all of them seem to carry, these super successful people. What are some of those things?
Well, the closer they get to finishing something, the more motivated they get. If they're reading a book, the closer they get to the end, the more driven they are. And that's because rather than getting really excited and trying to coast on it like an air balloon, where you're going to run out of steam as time goes on, what they do is they inflate themselves just enough to get going, and the more they get going, the more motivated they become. This is why I've written 24 books and helped people write another 24. I've not only written a lot of books, I've written for other people their books, because when I owned a publishing company, a lot of my authors that were filled with good ideas, but they couldn't seem to get it on paper. And part of the problem was is they got real excited, and then when they started typing, to them every word was more drudgery, because they didn't look at their goal as something to be drawn towards. They looked not doing it as something to move away from. See, if you always waited in school for the last minute before you studied for a test or the last minute before you wrote a paper, what you're doing is motivating yourself with stress. The more you run out of something, the more motivation you get, which is horrible if you're thinking about your finances, because if you have to get deeply in debt to get motivated to do something about it, that's a really bad strategy, especially for retirement. Yeah. But if the more you move toward success, you make a great big picture, and it can be bigger than the room you're in, where you see your future, and when you look at it, you go, this is what I really want, so you feel drawn towards it, then the closer you get to that goal, the stronger your feelings get. And when I teach people to change their life in that way, first with little things, even cleaning, see your house crystal clean, right? And you feel that you want that. And then everything you do, you make the picture of it being clean get bigger, not smaller, and closer, so that the more you get done, the better you feel. This is how you train yourself to be a finisher. Because, when you talk to these really successful people, they started with something small, and when they got done, then they made something bigger to do, and then they moved on to something even bigger still. I mean, some of them, the things they've accomplished are, by my standards, just absolutely incomprehensible, running companies with thousands of employees. Mm-hmm. I have trouble keeping track of my kids. I'm not designed to be an employer. To me, I'm really good with one person at a time, but it's just the idea of having to keep track of levels and levels of management. But a lot of these guys, it comes second nature to them, because constantly what they're doing is making sure every level is getting the level below it to finish what they're supposed to finish. This is how you do R&D and get a product out in the marketplace. This is how a salesperson, instead of just thinking about closing this sale, realizes every time they close a sale, they need 100 more prospects. If you're going to run a business, you can't think about what you have to do right now and wait till the last minute to do it. You have to go way out into the future and be drawn towards it so that you bathe yourself in success rather than run away from darkness.
Interesting. So what you're saying is that the people that are super successful, as they're about to complete a project, as they get kind of closer to the finish line, they get even more amped up to cross the finish line? Is that the
what you
mean?
They all use the same sentence in their head. A lot of them make these dreams which, are completely unrealistic. Whether it's being elected to political office or, setting up their own airline or, these things. But when they're going to the banks and they're doing these things and putting together all these pieces, they always say to themselves this thing. They go, I just might be able to do this. I might just succeed. Instead of that internal voice that goes, you'll never be able to do this, by having a different set of internal auditory things where you start saying to yourself, well, I just might be able to do this. And when you keep saying that, every time a roadblock comes up, you go, well, there just might be a way around this. It might just be somebody else that can help me. The other one is that rather than asking the prophets of doom, because everybody's around telling you you can't do things, television has been telling us for 3 years that the world is falling apart and we're all going to run out of money and gasoline and air and, we're all buried in snow in the United States while they're still talking about global warming. The prophets of doom are out there, and there may be a seed of truth in what they're saying. But, you know, there's still those people that are saying we can do something about this. You know, it's not too late. We can change things. And, you know, there are some people that just say it, but there are some that actually go out and do things. And what they fix typically is first their own life. Because, you know, there's nothing worse than, because I meet a lot of people in my business, you know, who talk a good game, but they don't seem to be able to accomplish it. They're telling mm-hmm. people they should be, you know, capable of, you know, living their lives. It's kind of like a lot of these people that are members of the moral majority, and we find that they're, you know, sleeping with their first cousin, and
right,
you know,
right.
You know, they're a major disappointment. But you know, these are people that that talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. But mm-hmm. you see, successful people have a tendency to talk to other successful people. You know, if you set up a small corporation and you put your lawyer and your accountant on your board of directors, rather than five or six retired successful business people, you make a big mistake, because successful people weren't successful because they were money grubbing. They liked what they did. You know, this guy that ran his own corporation for 50 years and then retires, you know, likes nothing better than talking about it, because that's what he liked doing. And they make good mentors for people to become successful. You know, if you're not good at getting over credit card debt, find somebody who is and who got out of credit card debt, and find out what they did and mm-hmm. do what they did. Don't just talk to people that tell you, you know, the end is here. I mean, you listen to Dave Ramsey on the radio, and good God, he gets all of these people to start planning, you know. And yep. some of them, when I hear him on the radio, I'm thinking, how the hell did he ever get these people to do it, you know? But it's not right. about being intelligent. It's about being determined, making a plan, and sticking to it. And if the same person, rather than waiting till they're $60,000 in credit card debt, stopped before it was too late and said, the currency of my life really counts, then they could make a plan so that instead of being $60,000 in debt, they could be $600,000 to the good in 5 years. Mm-hmm. And this is what I try to get people to do, to avoid bad things by doing really good ones. And this mm-hmm. is true financially. It's especially true in your marriage. Don't wait till things get bad and go to counseling. Make them good for no reason. You know, the more you do good things for your kids and the more you do good things for the people around you, the better things will happen to you. You spend the moments of your life wisely, and you get more good ones. It's just the way it is.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of people that when I ask them, they've come to me, you know, they're stalling in their financial life, and then I ask them, well, what would it be like if you didn't have all this stuff, and where would you like to be? I find that a lot of people they're not clearly defined where they even want to go financially or what they want to be. Do you
find
that as well?
One of the major reasons why I could take people who were given up on, locked away in mental hospitals, mm-hmm. is because I could go in and give those people the tools that it took to get themselves out. That if I had somebody that was hallucinating floridly, I taught them to stick their fingers through the hallucinations and stick their fingers, because when they poked me, there was something there, and when they poked the hallucination, there wasn't. Now, for them, that was the first step on getting a handle on reality. Then I would teach them what they were supposed to say to their doctors so the doctors thought they were getting better. Because, you know, there's a lot of traps. You know, the more you say you're not mentally ill, the crazier they think you are. And whether it's being locked in a mental hospital or locked in debt or locked in a cycle of madness in a marriage, you have to get to the point where you take the first step, where you start poking the stuff you don't like and finding out what's real and what's not real. And, you know, a lot of people think they need things they absolutely don't. You know, it was Freud's grandson that started all this advertising stuff on Madison Avenue. Because people used to get the Sears catalog, and if something was broken, they'd look up what they needed and order it. And they wanted to be able to sell people things they didn't need. And it's gone to absolutely ridiculous things. I mean, people were buying houses they couldn't afford. People are taking credit cards and running up debt that's more than they make in a year.
Right.
You know, and then they think it's going to disappear. Well, you know, if you owe more than you make in a year, it's going to take you a few years to pay it off. And you,
exactly.
you know, you may have to go out and get a second job so you can catch up. But if you could catch up, you know, if you think about it, if I'm $20,000 in debt and I could get out of it in 2 years, that means 2 years later I could be $20,000 to $40,000 to the good. You know, wouldn't it be nice to have, you know, a big pillow full of money to fall back on if something bad happens?
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
should be the lesson from this recession, is never get caught with your pants down.
Absolute. No, I agree.
Figuratively or literally.
Right, right. No, I talk to people, and it's always that I say, look, you got to stop using these credit cards. But I need this, but. And I have all these reasons why they need to rely on it. Like, they cannot manifest or create a circumstances where it's installed this automatic behavior where they've gotten so used to taking a piece of plastic out, and they don't feel what it's like to have money go from their hand to the cash register to the person that's buying. They don't even want to feel that anymore. It's a very strange phenomenon. I've been wanting to reach you regarding that for a long time. It's the installation of this kind of automatic behavior where they don't feel anything when they use their cards. And then I tell them, well, okay, why don't you go out and just use cash for 2 or 3 days? And it terrifies them. It's very bizarre.
Well, that's the fear they ought to have, because that's how they should feel when they buy stuff they don't need. It should scare them. They should think, do I need this, or do I need this money in the bank? See, they don't look at their bank account growing and get excited about it. That's the hard thing to teach people, you know. I mean, you know, I'm sitting down with my kids and going, look, if you look at your bank account and you go, last month there was this much in it, and this month there's more, then you get to this really great feeling. And then if you project that over a year and 2 years and 5 years, then you end up having enough money to buy a house without being buried in it. You know, that if you look at your own life, especially young people with kids and stuff, they think there's no way that they can save money. And of course there is, you know. It's too easy to spend money if it's a piece of plastic.
That's right.
If you don't really feel it. Some people don't even look. They just punch that code and bang, it's gone. Especially
credit cards.
They're even worse than debit cards. You know, I mean, to me, I think people should chop up their credit cards and go for the debit cards. You keep one credit card in reserve for when you travel so you can rent a car, get a hotel room or something, and pay it off at the end of the month. To me, you know, don't trust these people. They'll bury you in debt the first chance they get. You know,
right.
People who pay off their credit cards every month like me are called deadbeats by the credit card companies.
That's right. That's right. You're not a good client, Dr. Bandler, for the banks.
No, I'm a horrible client.
Right.
And my credit rating suffers because of it.
Yeah.
Because I don't owe anybody anything. I've been blacklisted by a lot of credit companies because, you know, I don't carry debt that way. And, you know, trying to teach people, you know, that the most important part is, you know, if you're going to use a credit card, you pay for it. But you don't think of it as if you're never going to, you know, eventually, because everything you spend translates into labor. This is what scares me about the national debt. You know, people talk about balancing the budget, but they haven't talked about paying off the national debt. It is
your
debt, and somebody's going to have to pay it off. And the collateral for it is our labor. And if you look at the national debt and you break it down to every man, woman, and child in the country, and, you know, even you think about your grandkids having to pay it, it boils down to a lot of money. We each have to cough up, like, you know, $70,000 to $100,000 each, you know, to get this under control. And most people don't have that kind of money. So, our politicians are talking about raising it a couple of $1 trillion.
Yep.
You know, I remember when I was a kid, the word million was really big. And now the word million isn't big anymore. The word billion is now disappearing into the word trillion is becoming a little too commonplace with politicians.
That's right. What is the difference between, I know you have design human engineering. Is that a subset of NLP or something different?
Well, actually, it's the opposite of NLP. NLP is where you go out and find a successful behavior. So you go out and find a great speller. You find out what he does inside of his head, and you extract it both consciously and unconsciously, and you teach somebody else to use the same process. Design human engineering, what you do is you figure out what would be the optimal. So where somebody, you elicit somebody's strategy, they may say to themselves in a really loud voice, you should go out and do this. And in design human engineering, you get 30 or 40 people to say it all at the same time, and you record it, and you listen to it over and over again until it goes into your head just like a McDonald's commercial, only instead of getting you to buy a McDonald's commercial, it gets you to, you know, be careful about spending money or things so that you end up with a choir in your head. And instead of just the pictures that you've learned to make over time, you make bigger pictures. You design what's in them. So it's kind of like being an interior designer, only what you design is the inside of your head. You know, how big the pictures are going to be, where you're going to locate them. It even goes for things like, I had somebody that had horrible balance. And if he was in a car and he started to go uphill, he would feel like he was going backwards downhill, so he couldn't drive. And he lived in Switzerland, and he actually was fairly wealthy, you know, but, you know, he wanted to be able to drive around town. He was a young guy, about 25, you know, worked at a bank, and, you know, he could get a ride to work every day, but, you know, he couldn't go anywhere. And when he, you know, he came to me, his psychiatrist gave me this long thing about his father and blah, and, you know, a psychosexual this, and, you know, if he shrinks, everything's about a penis somehow or other. While the guy was talking to me, all I could think about is that in my Jeep, there's a little thing with a bubble that sits on the dashboard. When you go up, the bubble is down, and when you go down, the bubble is down. So I went out and bought one at a hardware store, and I had him look at it, and then I hypnotized him, and I had him imagine one in his head. And as he leaned backwards, it went one way, and as he leaned forward, it went to the other, and if he tilted to the left. And pretty soon, he could imagine it in his mind and use it. And after about 2 weeks, without even thinking about it, he knew whether he was going up or down. He got his balance back. I had somebody who had suffered a head trauma and lost their balance. And I had been to Cirque du Soleil, and I saw somebody walk across a tightrope with this big, giant pole. Mm-hmm. And so I hypnotized this guy, and I put the pole through his head with a bubble in the middle, like a level. And so that if he started to lean to one side, he felt like he was really leaning. And if he felt to lean to the other side, he felt like he was almost being pushed over. And in a matter of a week or two, he started self-correcting. It built in sort of a hypnotic illusion that trained his neurology to start doing what it was supposed to again. Now, I don't know physiologically what had happened, which caused him to lose his balance in the first place. Some neurologists kept telling me about damage to the cortex and something in the inner ear and yada, yada, yada. But right. You see, I'm a hypnotist. I don't have to deal with reality, and I don't have to accept limitations. I've been doing things with people for 40 years that I've been told over and over and over again are impossible. I've gotten people to have feeling in hands that weren't there. You know, I've had people come to me with phantom limb pain and, you know, who were given horrible drugs, you know, I mean, massive amounts of really addictive narcotics, and they still had a pain in an arm that wasn't there. And when I look at the doctors who bring them, I go, so he has pain in his left arm and it's not there. And the doctor will go, yes. And I'll go, okay, when you give him the painkiller, which arm do you inject it in? And they go, the right arm. And I go, but the right arm is fine. It doesn't hurt. Why are you injecting it? And because the other arm isn't there. See, me, I give him a hallucinated injection and it disappears for life.
Fantastic.
You know, I'm not constricted by the limits of their understanding. I'm only restricted by the limits of what people can believe and put into action in their own lives. And so far, that seems to be pretty limitless.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Dr. Richard Bandler, I want to thank you very, very much. It's been an honor speaking with you. Everybody out there, richardbandler.com. Go there, buy the books. I've been talking about Dr. Bandler for a long time. Dr. Bandler, thank you very, very much.
Next time, don't wait 10 years. I'm not that hard to get a hold of.
Okay. All right, I'll be in touch. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Bandler. Everybody, go to richardbandler.com. Richard Bandler's Guide to Transformation. Get the life you want. Richard Bandler, you can get all those new current books on his website. Fantastic. Thank you very, very much, everybody. We'll see you again tomorrow. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Ka-ching.
PowerHits.com.
Hi, my name's Jack, and I'm an avid listener of Cash Flow with James Martinez. The global financial crisis is changing the world as we know it. If you've struggled for years trying to resolve your alleged credit card debt, I want you now to imagine your own personal financial freedom. The famous philosopher Lao Tzu once said, "A journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step." Take your first step in a new direction and notice how good it feels. Remember, life gets better when you're headed in a new direction, and your new direction is freedom from credit card debt. Please call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655.
Hi, Monique Chapman here, inviting you to join me, Walking with Spirit, every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. I showcase elite authors in the metaphysical, spiritual, and personal growth arena. Always informative and fun, join me, Walking with Spirit, America's premier metaphysical and personal growth talk show.